hurry is a condition of the soul. And it's when I'm so preoccupied with myself, with my agenda, with the things that I feel like I must do, with the burden of outcomes, with the worry about tomorrow, that I'm unable to be fully present with another person and unable to be aware of and relaxed in the presence of God. And he said, hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life.
This is the L3 Leadership Podcast, episode number 258. Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of the L3 Leadership Podcast, where we are obsessed with helping you grow to your maximum potential and to maximize the impact of your leadership. My name is Doug Smith, and I am your host, and in today's episode, you'll hear my interview with John Ortberg. If you're unfamiliar with John, let me just tell you a little bit about him. He is currently the senior pastor at Menlo Church. He is also on the board of trustees at Fuller Seminary. He's on the board for the Dallas Willard Center for Spiritual Formation, and he served on the board of Christianity Today International. He's written several books, one of which is called Soul Keeping, and that book significantly impacted my wife and I, and we recommend it to leaders everywhere we go. And so if you've not read Soul Keeping, please go buy a copy right now. In fact, with everything going on in our culture today, I don't feel like there's a more perfect book that you can read as a leader than Soul Keeping. In fact, I thought it was so important that that is pretty much all we focus on in this interview with John. We go through his book, Soul Keeping, and he talks all about it and why soul keeping is so important for leaders. So you're in for a treat, but before we dive into the interview, just a few announcements. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Baritone Advisors. The financial advisors at Baritone Advisors help educate and empower clients to help make informed financial decisions. Find out how Baritone Advisors can help you develop a customized financial plan for your financial future. Please visit their website at Baritone Advisors, that's Beratung, advisors.com. Securities and investment products and services offered through Waddell & Reed, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Baritone Advisors, Waddell & Reed, and L3 Leadership are separate entities. Hey leader, we tell you all the time here at L3 Leadership that you should never do life alone, but in community. And that's why I want to challenge every single one of you to become a member of L3 Leadership. When you become a member of L3 Leadership, you'll have access to our community of leaders who are willing to encourage you, support you, and hold you accountable for going after your goals. You'll also have access to monthly live webinars that we do with nationally known leaders, monthly Q&A and hot seat hours for our members where you can troubleshoot the issues that you're having with your goal and get live, real-time feedback on them to help you develop a plan to overcome those issues. You'll have access to every course that we ever create. You'll have access to every L3 one-day talk we've ever had, and so much more. And all of this is available for just $25 a month. In fact, we believe so much in the product that we are willing to give you your first month for just $1. That's right. If you sign up today at l3leadership.org, your first month of membership is just $1. Leader, don't grow another minute without having a community of leaders to which you can go to and grow with. Sign up today at l3leadership.org. Well, hey, John, it's a great honor to have you on the podcast today. And you've been on my bucket list interview for a long time. And so I'm very grateful for the opportunity to get to learn from you. And why don't we just start off with you just telling our podcast listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Thank you, Doug. It's great to be with you. I'm a pastor. I have been now for almost 17 years at Menlo Church, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so my primary responsibility really is to teach, to think about spiritual formation. What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? How do we help people to do that? How can our church do that more effectively? And then beyond that, I will speak and write about that topic in particular most often.
Yeah, and we're in, it's June 2020 at the time we're recording this, and still in the midst of this COVID crisis that's been going on for several months now. And the interviews I've been doing, I just kind of have been leaving it open-ended, and I'm just curious, with everything happening now, is there anything on your heart specific to leaders, whether it's something you're learning or something you want to challenge leaders to do in this time?
You know, this has been a time where because of COVID and shelter in place, that's created all kinds of uncertainty in the church and beyond that. And then we're walking through tremendous turmoil around racism and racial issues. The pain has always been there, but it's becoming more visible in lots of communities, particularly for folks who are white. And then for me personally, this has also been a season, even beyond those issues, where I have been walking through issues with our church, decisions that I've made that have just prompted questions from our church leaders to look at together, to walk through together, that have caused me to learn and ask questions. So I'd say this is a season when it's more clear than it usually is that God is the only foundation for life.
Wow.
And COVID reminds me I can't trust in my health. What happens with the economy reminds me I can't trust in my money. The racial issues remind us that there are problems in our country and our world that are far too big for any one human being to handle. My dad died a year ago, and I was with him as he breathed his last breath. And I thought about that a lot this last year, how short life is, how quickly death comes, how much it matters. So for anybody who's listening to us, if there's ever been a time to make sure that my life, our lives are grounded in God, now is that time.
Just out of curiosity, are you going to live any differently on the other side of this as a result of everything you're processing?
Yeah. I've actually shifted roles at church somewhat. So I've been in the senior pastor role, which has meant organizational leadership responsibilities, and I'm shifting out of those to be able to focus more on discipleship. What does it mean to follow Jesus? I think it's more clearly congruent with my own calling and gifts. And I think it also helps me move out of areas where I'm not as gifted, and that can be humbling. I'm a 3 on the Enneagram, so I want everybody to think that I'm great at everything, and I can recognize I don't really do this particularly well. I don't really manage people well. I don't supervise well. I'm not great at strategic planning. But then if somebody else says, you don't do that well, in the flesh, my response would be, what do you mean I don't do that well? I can do that great. And so it's been a learning journey for me to let go. And there's a lot of things that I am letting go of, have let go of, that I will let go of on the other side of it, and to make space for both calling around vocational ministry, but also relationally. I've always been a real early morning guy, and I've been in the office really early in the morning. And my wife has often said, I'm kind of like to have a man in my bed when I wake up in the morning, meaning me. And so I'm doing that now. We have a ritual where every morning we're together in the living room and we'll talk and pray and have coffee and tea. And when this is all over, that will continue to go on. So yeah, the rhythms of my life and time and work will be different coming out of this. And I'm really glad.
Can you just talk a little bit more about letting go and the Enneagram 3 thing? It's interesting you're saying that at this, you know, season of your leadership journey, for as long as it's been. But, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, Will's in his mid-20s, and we're wrestling the same thing. We want to be good at everything, but we're realizing we may not be. And so, can you just talk about letting go to leaders? I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, the leadership topic is such a fascinating topic, and it's so important. And I believe that part of why we're drawn to that word or fascinated by it is it reflects what does it mean to be made in the image of God and to exercise dominion, to be strong and powerful in the creation of the good. And so that word leader connotes a lot. What does it mean to be a person who has significance and influence? And we were made for that. Human beings are not content to be just one more brick in a building. We're each unique and we're made to have a unique contribution, and that's a really good thing. But of course, sin gets into it, and it does for me, and then I want to be not just significant, but more significant. And if some other pastor does better than me, has a bigger church, preaches a better sermon, sells more books, whatever it is, it can threaten my own sense of well-being. And as soon as any of that happens, I'm not living in the kingdom of God. And I'm not becoming the person that God most wants me to be. And so learning to be able to let go of that. And often letting go will involve specific concrete things. For Zacchaeus, he had to let go of money. For the woman caught in adultery, she had to let go of that relationship. And for, I think, a lot of us threes on the Enneagram, to let go of tasks, to let go of responsibilities, to let go of reputation, to be okay with saying, no, I really don't do this well. The feedback that I get from other people is, you don't really do this well, but God still loves me as much as ever. So it's a good chance to learn that God's love for me is not tied to my performance. I always know that in my head, I preach that. It's another thing to experience it at the soul level. And so walking through a season like this and letting go, there's actually pain in the midst of doing it, but great freedom on the other side.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing that. You know, I think a lot of people would probably look at you in your position and never think that you're wrestling with letting go. And so I think that's very, very powerful. And I think something all of us can learn from. And that actually leads into to the primary focus of what I wanted our conversation to be about is you wrote a book called Soul Keeping. And it's greatly impacted my life, my wife's life, and thousands and thousands of leaders' lives all over the world. And, you know, what I love about the book is, and another book actually I read in conjunction with this is John Mark Comer's Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. And I saw you guys had a conversation on that the other, not so long ago. And the premise of this book is your life significantly changed when Dallas Willard told you, hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day, and you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. Can you tell us a little bit about that story, when you heard that and where you were in your journey and why that made such a big impact?
Yeah, I grew up in the church. I was always interested in change and the human condition and why is it difficult to change and where is God in the midst of that? And I grew up in a tradition where I knew that I was supposed to read the Bible each day and pray every day to have a quiet time. But beyond that, I didn't know a lot to do to try to pursue change, and I wasn't finding change happening in my life at levels that I wanted to. And it was really reading the work of Dallas Willard, who a lot of our listeners probably may have heard of. For me, the gateway book to Dallas was a book called The Spirit of the Disciplines, and it was, outside of the Bible, continues to be the single book that has impacted me the most deeply.
Wow.
And so after I read it, and it was clear that this was somebody who had thought very deeply about transformation. The thesis sentence in the book, I remember where I was sitting on the plane when I read this sentence. I said, my thesis is that authentic transformation is possible if we're willing to do one thing, and that is to arrange our lives around those practices and rhythms that Jesus engaged in, to be constantly at home with and receiving power from his Father.
Wow.
And when I read that sentence, I thought, somebody has thought deeply about this stuff. And so I wrote him, and he actually invited me to come over to his house. It turns out that we lived only a few miles away from each other in Southern California. And when I went to his home for the first time and we sat and talked for a couple hours, it was very clear that this is the smartest guy I ever met, but his heart was better than his mind. And among other things, he was deeply humble. When you would talk with Dallas, whoever the person was, you would just feel like you were the most important person in the world, because that kind of love flowed out of him. And he was very unhurried. I remember that first night, that was back before cell phones and answering machines, and the phone would ring and he would just let it ring and not answer it while we were talking. Nobody does that. And so he was the kind of person where anybody that you talk to, if they knew Dallas much at all, they would tell you they want to be like him. They want to have that kind of life, because it was just a deep peace and deep humility. And so a few years after I met him, we had moved to Chicago, and I was involved at Willow Creek Church, which was a thriving, very active place. And I asked Dallas if I could talk to him maybe once a month just for wisdom about life. And so it was on, I think, the first of those calls when he asked me to describe what life was like there and what ministry was like and so on. And so I did. And then there was, you know, that long pause with Dallas. There was always a long pause. And then he said, when I had asked, what do I need to do to be spiritually alive and healthy? And he said, you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And he talked about how there's a difference between busyness and hurry. Busy is a outward condition of the body, having many things to do, but hurry is a condition of the soul. And it's when I'm so preoccupied with myself, with my agenda, with the things that I feel like I must do, with the burden of outcomes, with the worry about tomorrow, that I'm unable to be fully present with another person and unable to be aware of and relaxed in the presence of God. And he said, hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life.
So you heard those words. You were at an organization that was high performance, high speed, go, go, go. What did that journey look like from that moment you heard that forward? And what does it look like today? What does ruthlessly eliminating hurry in your life look like tactically?
Yeah, it's been a lifelong journey for me. I think my wiring and temperament are such that I value being productive. I value getting things done. I value looking like I'm productive. And those are not all bad things. And partly they're a result of wiring. I will often tend to think fast or move fast. So for me, I've had to be very conscious about it. And it's involved building practices into life like solitude. And there have been times in life when the rhythm might look like a day a month when I go away to just spend an entire day in solitude on a regular basis. Currently, I've just been through a process with two other friends where we spent the better part of the last year going through what are called the spiritual exercises of Ignatius. And so that's meant having a large chunk of time each day, again, which is set aside to do nothing. Part of it will be for prayer. Part of it will be for reflection and learning. Partly it's meant asking Nancy on a really regular basis, tell me when you see hurry in my life, and sitting down with her to do planning so that when invitations or commitments come in, instead of responding to them one at a time and then getting way overcommitted, I'll just save them up until there's a batch of them and sit down together with Nancy and the administrative assistant that I work with. And we will go through them all together so that most of them we can say no to, and seek to have a sustainable rhythm of life together.
In the book, you talk about busyness, and you shared the quote that people hear often: "If the devil can't make you sin, he'll make you busy," because either way, your soul will shrivel. And similar to what we talked about in the beginning of the podcast, is leaders have trouble letting go of things because they find their worth in their performance. They feel like they have to be doing a million things at once. What would your challenge be? Because I feel like leaders all over today feel like they have to be busy. And I guess in your experience, did you have to be as busy as you were, you know, in your time at Willow? Did you change the way you put what's on your plate, what's not on your plate? What would you challenge leaders to when it comes to being busy?
Yeah. I think it's, there's often an illusion that the primary challenge is external and it's about time management. And certainly learning how to manage time well and to manage energy well is really important, to understand what's energizing to me and what's draining to me, and how do I work to arrange my life and my work so that I'm trying to focus mostly on doing those things that tend to be naturally energizing. Learning is naturally energizing to me, communicating is. So those aspects are part of it. But I think for most of us, and certainly for me, the bigger challenge is an internal life character soul challenge, where I have to face the fact that I'm afraid. I'm afraid of not being important. I'm afraid of not being successful. I'm afraid of being kind of marginalized while there are other people that are the ones who really matter, and I'm not one of those. And it's really fear and a deep need to be loved and feel significant that I think drive hurry, at least for me. Mm-hmm. And if I don't recognize that, be aware of it, talk about that with, I've just built intense season with a counselor looking at exactly those kinds of thoughts If I deal with those thoughts so that I can live in the reality that God loves me no matter what, then hurry doesn't get a hold of me in the same way. But if I feel like it's my worth that's on the line, any indicator of lagging performance can activate my adrenaline, and then I'm just a slave to it.
Wow. And so in the book, you talk about this is the whole reason we need to take care of our souls. And you talk about several things that the soul needs. And, you know, I can share some of them, but I think to set it up, can you just talk about what a soul is? You know, people listening to this might be like, a soul, I have to take care of my soul. And you really set up a book in the front end of the book talking about it. Can you share about what a soul is, and then we'll talk about how to keep it?
Yeah, I'd love to. And it's just a wonderful topic. And again, I'm deeply indebted to Dallas for his thoughts on it. He would say that none of this is original with him. It goes way back to ancient thinkers. Often in our day, people think that science has somehow proven that the soul does not exist, and especially neuroscience, because there's so much prestige around it, will often communicate to people that you are nothing more than your brain. But the truth is that the deepest part of us is not seen. We can see synapses firing. We cannot see ideas. We cannot see intentions. These things are real, but they're not the same thing as synapses. They are not seen. Science has not and will not prove that there is not such a thing as a soul. And there's nothing unscientific about that language. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's incredibly important to everybody listening to us that you understand that you do have a soul. It took me a long time to understand what Dallas meant by soul. And it turns out a lot of people have real fuzzy ideas. There's another guy, a psychiatrist and Episcopal clergyman, who's done a lot of research on what church people think of souls. And he said most people have what might be called the Looney Tunes theory of the soul. If you ever watch the cartoon where Daffy Duck dies, gets hit by an arrow, and then this thin, whispery version of him rises up from the ground. People think of that as the soul. And so it's important to know that in the ancient world generally, and in the Bible in particular, that's not what people thought of when they would think of the soul. If you think about what does it mean to be a person, Dallas would say you have a will, you're able to choose to say yes or no. You have a mind, so you can think and feel. You have a body, mostly appetites and habits. You have relationships. And then the soul is what integrates all of that into one single person, into one single being. Ancient thinkers called the capacity to integrate separate functions into one life or one organism, soul. So it's essentially integrative. And what sin does is to disintegrate. It splits off my values from my behavior, or my face from what it is I'm really thinking inside. Sin disintegrates the soul. The soul is very deep. It's what connects you to God. It's so deep that it's the one part of the person in the Bible that there and elsewhere in the ancient world, people would address their soul as if it was a separate person. Why are you downcast, O my soul? Or bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. That's the soul. All that is within me, bless his holy name. To take care of your soul means, you know, not just to be well rested, although that's part of it. When Jesus said, what does it profit a person if they gain the whole world but lose their soul? I used to think that meant, you know, it doesn't do you any good to have a lot of pleasure, a lot of sex, or a lot of money if you're going to go to hell when you die. And that's not what he was saying. It's true, but it's not what he was saying. What he's saying is, if once there's a disintegration so that my thoughts conflict with each other and conflict with my values, and who I look like I am is different than who I actually am, and instead of my will being able to rule my body rules my will, and so I have addictions to or sex or whatever, then look at Amy Winehouse, look at Howard Hughes, look at you and me. It's impossible to have even satisfaction, let alone a meaningful life. So that notion of a lost soul is not just one that's going to the wrong place. It is one that has become disintegrated at every level. And if you lose that, if you lose your soul, there's nothing in the world that you can get that can give you a meaningful life. And that's why understanding and caring for your soul matters more than anything else. If you lose that, you've lost it all.
Yeah, so let's talk about taking care of your soul. You made a statement in the book. You said, I and no one else is responsible for the condition of my soul. You must arrange your days so that you are experiencing deep contentment, joy, confidence in your everyday life with God. Mm-hmm. Love that statement. We're responsible for keeping our soul, but how do we actually do that?
Well, you have to know the parts of the soul. It's a little bit like a car. How do you take care of the car? And I'm a terrible cook. I know nothing about cars. You have to know how does the brake system work? How does the transmission work? When do the tire treads get worn down? You have to know the parts and how they function and if they're working well or not. So with the soul, there's no great mystery to it. I have a will. I make choices. And so I ask myself, am I choosing well and wisely? And am I actually doing the things that I choose to do? Or do I find myself claiming that I intend to be a good father, to be with my children, to manage anger well or so, and then I don't do those things? So I look at my choices. I look at my thoughts, and the mind is the most important part. If you think about like Paul saying in Romans 12, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So when I step back and look at my thoughts, I've been thinking, Doug, it's really interesting a lot the last couple of days about worship. As we've been going through shelter in place, one of the things that I learned is often in prayer, I can do Thanksgiving okay, I can do petition, I can do confession, but worship gets dry for me pretty quick. I start by saying, God, I praise you for being faithful or something, and it's hard for me to sustain that. And so to go back and think about worship means that God is so present in my mind and that I am so convinced that there is no catch, no limit to the goodness of his intentions or his power to carry them out, as Dallas would say, that all of my conversations like this one, what I'm doing from one moment to the next, I am doing in the conscious awareness of this magnificent friend.
Wow.
And if I'm living in that reality, my mind will be thinking thoughts that are true and wanting desires that are good and noble. And then they will be congruent with my will, my choices that I make. And then my body will be much more at peace and at rest. And so there'll be congruence or alignment between what it is that I'm thinking and what it is that I'm choosing and what it is that I'm wanting and what it is that I'm doing and how I am with you or somebody else. And when all of those line up, when all of those are integrated together, then the soul is at rest. The soul is real deep and real important. It doesn't have much power. It's very needy. In one book on Hebrew anthropology, the soul, nefesh, was described as needy man, the needy man. And that's why very often you'll see statements like Jesus say, and you will find rest for your soul. Our souls need to be rested. And so the primary way that you care for your soul is to very carefully monitor your thoughts. Are they true? Are they healthy? Are they wise? Your desires, the choices that you make, the rhythms that you push your body through. And when those are integrated and aligned together with God, then you will have a rested soul.
In this area of soul keeping and just the whole topic we've been talking about, I'll just leave this really open-ended and then we'll start to transition into the lightning round. But what else, would, if leaders listening to this or you, you know, X amount of years ago when you called Dallas and saying, here's where I'm at, what would you tell me? What would you tell our listeners today?
I think particularly for people who are involved in leadership, because it is such a good thing to do and to want to impact the world and other people well, it's such a good thing to do, always our greatest temptations end up very closely connected with our gifts and our aspirations. You know, nobody's tempted to do something in 180 degrees the opposite direction. So the temptations are always things that just lead us a bit off path. And you see this with Jesus when he's tempted by Satan, and it's you know, do something spectacular and get people to worship you. Well, he wanted to move people to worship. So it's temptation is always that way. And I think for most of us leaders, the temptation is to sell our souls for outcomes.
Wow.
And so learning to live well with outcomes is really important. And I remember being with Dallas one time when he had finished giving a talk and we were walking out to the parking lot, and Dallas is an amazing thinker. He would often talk in kind of a monotone, quite professorial, and sometimes people would hang with him and sometimes they wouldn't. And this was one of those talks where I would say, if you were just looking at, did the crowd go, people were not real electrified by it. But he was just singing an old hymn as we were walking out to the car. And I realized there was not a cell in his body that was asking the question, how do you think the talk went? Did the talk go good? Did people like it? Do I still have my fastball? What do you think? How did it go? It was like he gave the talk, wanted God to use it. But then when it was done, like watching a kid let go of a helium balloon, it's just gone. And I thought watching that, how often I carry the weight of outcomes. And if I give a talk and it went good, I feel great. And if I give a talk and I think that it didn't go well, I feel inadequate or ashamed or like a failure. And so to hold outcomes in the right way, on the one hand, it's very important to look reality square in the face and to learn from it. And so if I really want to be a speaker, but I'm not good at it, I need to be open to the feedback that says, nope, that's not how God has wired me up. For me, when it comes to things like seeking to do organizational leadership, I can do it in some ways, not well in other ways, to be really open to here's the feedback that I get and be willing to let it go. That's very important. So we do have to pay attention to outcomes. We do have to learn from outcomes. But I never place my well-being, my ego, my personhood, my identity on the back of an outcome. And when leaders get that wrong, everybody in the organization can smell it. And then what happens is you get whole organizations where Jim Collins wrote about this in one of his books. People are more worried about what the leader thinks of reality than they are about reality.
Wow. That's powerful.
Yeah. So I think to learn how to bear outcomes really well, how to face them with great courage and openness and utter truthfulness, and then wear them incredibly lightly. And let go. Just let go. Your worth as a human being has nothing to do with any outcome of anything you're leading. It's not about me. It's not about you.
Re-looking over my notes. So obviously when you can find your identity in outcomes or performance, and then reality hits, that can often lead to disappointment. And you actually talk about in the book this concept of strategic disappointment. Yeah. Can you talk about that? I thought that was fascinating. I just want to hear you expound on that.
Yeah. So often what I want is I'm more concerned with the circumstances of my life than the person I'm becoming. But God is much more concerned about the person I'm becoming than the circumstances of my life. Dallas used to say the main thing God gets out of your life is the person you become.
Wow.
And that's the main thing you get out of your life. It's not your resume. Even if you're in the church, it's not the church that you build. It is the person that you become. And the wonderful news about that is there is nothing, there is nobody, there are no elders, there is no secular tide in society, there's no trends on the church growth side that can get in the way of you becoming the right person. But part of what that means then is often when I am disappointed in some outcome, what I need is for God to show me my false or idolatrous attachment to that outcome. And so learning to live with disappointment. That talk didn't go the way that I wanted to. Well, it's a real good thing to remember. I'm actually not the one in charge of talks.
Yeah.
I'm not a gumball machine where you put a quarter in and it comes out, and I haven't mastered it. I've been doing it for a long time. There is no formula. That's a really good thing. And when one comes out and it's a disappointment, I'm reminded again, it's all in God's hands. And it's my job to work diligently at it and do the best that I can, but to be able to let go of it and still be loved by God and live with disappointment in ways that can form my character to be freer and healthier and simpler and humbler is a real good thing. And you just can't form character without disappointment.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for writing the book. If you're listening to this or watching this and have not read Soul Keeping by John Ortberg, you need to get a copy of it now. And it's just one of the many great books that he's written. So, John, the best place to find you and your work?
JohnOrtberg.com. You know, you can Google stuff.
Yeah. Yep. Easy to find. So we'll include links.
I'm at Menlo Church, so I should probably mention that. Menlo Church, you go online.
Awesome. And we'll include links to all of that in the show notes. With the few minutes we have left, I do want to dive into the lightning round. Again, this is just a fun round of questions that we love to run through with leaders. And the first one is, what is the best advice you've ever received and who gave it to you?
Ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. That was from Dallas Willard. He would be at the top of a list of probably about 20 statements.
This may be the same answer. Maybe you can use a different one. If you could put a quote on a billboard for everyone to read, what would it say?
You know, another deeply influential guy for me was Max Dupree. And Max used to say, the first task of a leader is to define reality. And so in thinking about leadership, especially as you look at a season like this where things are murky, things are difficult, you just live in that one. First task of a leader is to define reality. And that's gold.
Wow. Best purchase you've made in the last year for $100 or less?
Actually, a book that's just a super fun book to read, which is called Gentleman in Moscow. It's a novel, but I've just gotten so much joy out of that. So that was super fun. Can I do one that was a little bit more than 100?
Yes.
So my daughter and son-in-law got this exercise thing called the Mirror.
Oh, yeah. I've seen commercials.
Get an app on your phone, and it's like much less expensive than another cycling method that I won't mention, but it's killing me, man. I did it two nights ago. My legs are still really, really sore. So the Mirror, I love the Mirror.
Wow. You're the first user I've met. And so, it's good to hear the good reviews. You've talked about your favorite book. If you're a podcast listener, what are your go-to podcasts? One or two of them.
I like Kerry Newhoff a lot. Yes. I think he's terrific. Malcolm Gladwell is really fun to listen to. I think Andy Stanley on leadership and church leadership stuff is really, really fun to listen to. So those guys are all great. I have to admit, I'm just kind of embarrassed to do it. I just don't listen to a whole lot of podcasts. They're great. I just don't listen to a lot.
What do you wish people knew about your journey that they may not know?
I wish they knew what a fun person my wife is. A lot of people know Nancy. She speaks and writes and so. And, you know, I had no idea at the time. I was way too emotionally immature to understand it, but I married way up, although Nancy says all men marry up.
That's a fact.
She has been just a great joy.
That's awesome. When you meet with a leader, is there a question that you always ask no matter what leader you're meeting with?
I love learning and growth is very motivating to me. So what are you learning? Asking people, what are you learning today? I have another friend, a guy named Sam Reeves, who's a marketplace guy, fascinating person. And he talks a lot about the margins and that if you want to know what's going on in the world, you go to the margins, you go to those places where people may be in obscurity or in need. They're having to experiment. They're having to invent. They're having to create. They're desperate. They're cutting edge. Life at the margins is really where you find out what's going on. And so to ask people, what are you learning right now, is always very motivating to me.
Is there anything you're learning currently that you haven't shared with us already?
Learning to let go of my reputation. That's been part of the journey for me over the last several months for just a whole variety of reasons. And again, it's both painful, but also a really, really good thing.
What is your biggest leadership pet peeve?
Arrogance, pride, arrogance. You know, I think that's part of where it's very hard. The key word in the Bible to talk about personhood is kingdom. We all have a kingdom. Your kingdom is the range of your effective will, where things are the way that you want them to be. It's part of why that word leadership is such an important thing, because we are all meant to have a kingdom for our wills to make a difference. It's very hard to lead people without violating their kingdom. And so learning, how do I lead effectively without intimidating, manipulating, steamrolling, using? It's very hard to lead people without violating their kingdom. And that's why with Jesus, so many of his statements about leadership really are warnings.
Mm-hmm. What is something that you've crossed off your bucket list that everyone should do?
Gosh. You know what? My favorite drive in the world is Big Sur. I live not real far from there, but if you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, you get down to Monterey, and then you keep going south. There's about 90 miles of coastline until you get down to Hearst Castle and these bluffs that go down to the ocean. It's beautiful. It's soulful. It's, yeah, go drive Big Sur.
What's one thing left on your bucket list?
Oh, wow. I've never been to Russia. I would love to go to Russia.
Awesome. If you could go back and have coffee with your 20-year-old self, what would you tell him?
I would say pursue humility. I think the farther I go in life, humility is one of those words that I think probably when I was 20 didn't sound like a real attractive thing to me or a real exciting thing. And now I think there's so much freedom in it that it's a wonderful thing. I think people that have actually gone very far in it are the happiest people in the world. So yeah, I think I would say pursue humility.
And on the other end of your life, what do you want your legacy to be?
You know, I remember a guy named Bob Russell, a pastor, one time when he was getting close to retirement, somebody asked him about legacy. And his comment was, what matters is not legacy, is that the work continues. And I thought that was just a great statement. So whenever I hear the word legacy, I will always think about that. I suppose what that means is the more I can live the right kind of life and be with people in good ways, the more that they can do good work and be better people themselves. So it just kind of lives on through blessing other people. But that sentence, it's not about the legacy, it's about work going on, is the one that I really remember around legacy.
Anything else you want to leave leaders with today?
Yeah. Especially if you're involved with local church stuff, it gets harder and harder. COVID's really hard. Speaking with courage and vision around issues of racial injustice can be very challenging. The average age of a pastor keeps getting older and older. So what I would say to you is it is worth it. It's worth the energy. It's worth the difficulty. It's worth the challenge. It's worth the sweat. It's worth the confusion. It's worth the tears. If you ever wonder, you know, am I just insane to be doing this? Should I be doing something else? You just need to hear whoever you are, whether you're there vocationally or not, to seek to build up the local congregation, the bride of Jesus, is a noble and worthwhile thing to do. So don't give up. Don't quit. God bless you as you do it.
Oh, and John, thank you for not giving up. Thank you for your years of faithfulness in the kingdom. Thank you for being an example to my generation and the generations to come. And we're just so grateful for you. And thanks for the conversation today. It was rich, and I know it's going to add value to a ton of leaders. So thank you. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Henny Jewelers. They're a jeweler owned by my friend and mentor, John Henny. My wife, Laura, and I both got our engagement and our wedding rings at Henny Jewelers, and we absolutely love them. Not only do they have great jewelry, but they also invest in people. In fact, they give every engaged couple a book to help them prepare for their marriage, and we just love that. And so if you're in need of a good jeweler, check out Henny Jewelers at hennyjewelers.com. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, BAB Inc. BAB is an insurance broker, a third-party administrator, and consulting firm led by my friend and mentor, Russell Livingston. Russell is extremely passionate about developing the next generation of leaders, which is why he's partnering with us on this podcast, and he's also opened up his offices here in Pittsburgh to host our monthly leadership events, and we are extremely grateful for that. The nonprofit that I work at, Light of Life Rescue Mission, started using BAB as our insurance broker around 3 years ago, and we've had an unbelievable experience with them, and we highly recommend them. So if you or your organization has any insurance needs, please check out and learn more about BAB at babbins.com. That's BABBINS.com. Well, hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to our interview with John. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. For ways to connect with John and links to everything we discussed, you can find those in the show notes at l3leadership.org/258. Thanks again for listening to the podcast. As always, it would mean the world to me if you would share your key takeaways on social media, leave us a rating and review. It helps us grow our audience and add value to more leaders. So thank you in advance for that. And as always, I like to end with a quote. Today, I will quote Henry Ford, and he said this. He said, "A business that makes nothing but money is a poor business. So good, leaders." Hey, thanks for listening and being a part of L3 Leadership. My wife, Laura, and I appreciate you so much, and we will talk to you next episode.